Welcome to Think Like an Owner, a show exploring how the most ambitious CEOs grow great companies. I'm your host, Alex Bridgman. Each week, I dive into the strategies and tactics that build transformative businesses with the operators doing it firsthand. You can learn more about the guests and the companies they are building by visiting us at tlaopodcast.com. There, you will also find our weekly newsletter that further analyzes how companies are finding success today. Lastly, if you enjoy Think Like an Owner, please share this podcast with a peer and leave us a review. My guest today is Dennis Dresser. Dennis was a sales leader at IBM and Oracle and became CRO at Anaplan and Dialpad before taking on an advisory role with companies looking to develop best-in-class sales organizations. Through his career, he's developed a playbook for creating these high-performing sales teams and has thought deeply about talent management, performance management, and implementing better process. This episode dives into some of that playbook, along with characteristics to look for in hiring great sales leaders, scaling sales orgs, sales qualification methodologies, and so much more. Please enjoy this episode with Dennis Dresser. When it comes to accounting, quality of earnings reports, and financial due diligence, it's vital to have a partner who understands your business and what you're trying to accomplish. Jerry Joe and his team at Hood & Strong in San Francisco have a specialty for search funds and lower middle market private equity, with multiple podcast guests today trusting them with their partnership. Email Jerry at jzhou@hoodstrong.com and visit their search fund landing page at hoodstrong.com to learn more. For advice and observations on accounting for small companies, here's Jerry himself to share his expertise on today's Q&A. What should you budget for a quality of earnings report?
Typically, the budget for a small business acquisition ranges anywhere as low as $10,000 for a light QOV, quality of earnings analysis, to as high as typically about $25,000 or so in the mid-20s. And of course, this depends on the complexity of the business itself, just the quality and the conditions of the books. But generally speaking, that range is a pretty good estimate. And the way that we help kind of manage that cost and managing the cost of the quality of earnings is especially important in this space. And primarily, there is a lot of uncertainties around whether the deal is viable and it's going to go to the finish line. And so the way we manage the cost is, as I mentioned, in the phase one and phase two approach, allows at least to take on certain risk in the early stage of the process. So if the deal doesn't work out, doesn't make sense, and then it has to terminate, then we're looking at a cost that's basically a fraction of the total cost. So it makes that process a little bit more manageable.
Awesome. Thanks, Jerry. To learn more about Hood & Strong, please reach out to Jerry directly at jzhou@hoodstrong.com and visit their search fund landing page at hoodstrong.com for more information. I also want to thank our other sponsors, Ravix Group and Oberly Risk Strategies, for supporting the show. And now to the episode.
You've been a part of a lot of different sales teams, both as an executive, but also as an investor and advisor. I'd love to hear kind of maybe some of the things you've learned in the different career opportunities that you've had so far.
Absolutely, Alex. Thanks for having me on the show. Yeah, I've been very fortunate to work for some very high-performing companies, both public and private, and been surrounded by incredible mentors, executives and peers as well. So over the course of the last 25 plus years, taken a lot of the learnings from the experiences and built what I call a high performance revenue growth playbook, which I've then deployed to multiple companies where I was the CRO, as well now with our portfolio companies. I'm an investor and advisor in private equity SaaS companies, very early stage as well as growth stage. And so it's been really rewarding for me to wear a different hat now as an advisor, working with the executive teams, working with the heads of sales in these portfolio companies. And again, sharing all the lessons learned and best practices with them and helping them really drive profitable growth.
What were some roles where you feel like you had the greatest kind of learning curve?
I would say when I started at Eloqua, a marketing automation company in 2010. It was my first SaaS company that I had joined. And so one of the things that I learned very quickly was we have to earn every dollar every day, right? Because it's a subscription-based company. And so it wasn't just on-prem where you could sell the software and then, you know, move on to the next prospect and not necessarily worry about adoption and ongoing customer satisfaction and success. You obviously had to continue to engage them on their customer journey, right, through deployment, through adoption, and ultimately through ROI, which I thought was a great learning for me in terms of building this value selling methodology and really helping our prospects identify those key metrics that they need to address with our software and ensuring that we have, again, an implementation plan and a success plan to continually tie back to those metrics to make sure kind of jointly as partners, we were moving the needle, whether it was on, you know, acquiring new customers for them, or if it was generating, you know, net dollar retention, whatever those metrics were, we would make sure that, you know, every touch point we had through their journey, again, as a customer, that we were implementing the right processes, leveraging the right features and functions to ensure that they were getting that expected ROI. So that was, again, probably the biggest learning is working with the customer success team post-sales on that continual journey.
Yeah, what kind of changes did you make to the sales team, knowing that the sales process doesn't stop once they become a customer? There's this ongoing making sure that they're getting ROI from the product and they're using it properly and customer success is clued in. What changes had to happen to your sales team to make that an effective overall process?
We had to document in pre-sales more than we probably ever did, you know, in the on-premise world, meaning, you know, using our CRM, we would document those key metrics. We would document, you know, desired outcomes that the prospect would have, right, with our software. We would make sure that we had really good handoffs between our sales team and our solution consultants to our delivery team. And in fact, bring the delivery team, you know, into pre-sales at a certain stage. Normally it would be sort of the scoping stage of the sales cycle. But again, that transition, that handoff in terms of documentation, in terms of conversations, and then really kickoff calls. Once we actually landed the new prospect, we had a kickoff call. We would really demand, if you will, that we bring both executives that sponsored the project onto the kickoff call. So we had that alignment around the delivery plan, around what was the most important outcomes that they were looking to address. So I think that, again, that handoff between sales and our delivery team and success team was something that we really drove accountability on the sales rep to really own.
Yeah, it sounds like bringing on the executive sponsors into those onboarding calls would, I would think, help reduce churn. Were there other activities along the process that you noticed or could measure an impact on churn?
I think the ongoing, so whether it's a monthly or a quarterly customer success review, I saw a lot of companies would not bring in the executives to those calls, just the users, right? But I think it's really critical. We found that companies, my companies as well as Portco's, that actually have follow-up touches with both mutual exec sponsors, again, prospect executive that was really going to be funding the project that was responsible for whatever key metric we were solving for, as well as on our side, having a key executive involved to shadow and shepherd those customer success reviews. Again, throughout that journey, right, was, I think, a really critical factor in getting the desired return on investment, getting really high gross retention with that customer. So I continually espouse that as a key best practice, especially, of course, on the larger accounts, larger customers, right? Larger ARR opportunities.
Is there an ideal cadence, whether between monthly, quarterly, or biannual, that you've found to be the kind of the sweet spot for frequency? Or is it product dependent too?
It's probably product dependent, as well as like the customer size and complexity dependent. But I think quarterly is the right cadence at the executive level. Certainly, it's a more frequent cadence at the user level with the customer success team. But certainly quarterly, I think building a more structured, formal customer success, you know, review, you know, executive level presentation on a quarterly basis to check in and making sure, again, we're mutually tracking. I think that was the right cadence, right sweet spot.
Can you talk a little bit about the high performance sales kind of framework you've put together and what are the key elements of it?
Certainly. So I have a framework that I use, which is called People, Process, and Performance Management. And so when I think about, you know, developing a high performance team, I think first off on the people. What are the right ideal candidate profiles that we need in the sales organization based on doing some profiling of our high performers in the company? And then obviously wanting to replicate, right, and build the team and scale the team with those types of profiles. And then process is looking at our sales process, understanding where we're, you know, executing well in our sales process, be it discovery, be it demoing, be it in solutioning, and where we're not doing well. And we can then, we can determine where we're doing well and not doing well based on looking at our conversion and velocity from stage to stage. And so we instrument our CRM to be able to report, as well as using BI tools, to be able to report on that conversion and velocity. And we start with creating a baseline, right? How are we converting and how fast are we moving deals down the funnel today? And then benchmarking ourselves, right? So I've been lucky to work with a variety of SaaS companies and also having a lot of research data that I could then apply to my specific company based on, you know, what stage we are, you know, in our life cycle, what's the complexity, right, of the products that we sell. And so, you know, use those benchmarks, right, to then set goals for our team and our individuals on executing, you know, down that funnel. And then performance management, right? Let's establish those dashboards, right, that show us the leading indicators on those key metrics and, you know, stop lighting how we're doing, and then put a cadence in place around pipeline forecast management. And we do it at a, you know, organization level. We'll do it at an individual level so we can start stack ranking individuals and really identifying, you know, where individuals are really falling short across those key conversion and velocity metrics. And that shines a light on what skill gaps we have, right? Do we need to do some discovery training? Do we need to do some training around better negotiations? So it's a pretty well-oiled playbook and performance management structure that I've been able to really fine-tune over time to, again, build, scale, right, and execute in a high-performance sales organization.
What's the most recent adjustment that you've made to your playbook, most recent refinement or learning that you've included with it?
What we found, especially, you know, in this last 2 years where it's a more challenging market for sure to sell into, that value selling, right, which really is focusing on engaging these prospects, right, early top of funnel, and being able to really spend more time doing discovery on those key metrics that they need to address in order to hit financial goals, for example. And so I think what we've had to do with the team is develop some curriculum, some training to help them with some, you know, business acumen to effectively engage with business owners, business executives around those metrics in their business. Historically, I would say, you know, most teams are built, right, with more feature function selling skills. And that, you know, was probably fine in the previous 8 years, right, where it was sort of the growth at all cost and there was a ton of demand. But certainly, right, the pendulum has shifted significantly the last 2 years. Companies are actually rationalizing, right, the amount of technology they have. And so we really needed to focus more on value selling skills. So that's been a real big shift the last 2 years, I would say.
And taking a look at that first P, the people, what are some characteristics you found are common across successful salespeople?
Definitely. Hungry, humble, and intelligence. Those are sort of, to me, foundational, you know, profile attributes that correlate to our high performers. Beyond that, we look at, you know, have they had a consistent track record of hitting goals? Have they had experience, right, as an athlete, as a musician. Those are really, you know, and where they had to fine tune their whatever craft that was, right? What was their training regimen, you know, and tell me, walk me through that training regimen and what were your goals, right? And whatever that, you know, sort of ambition was. So we're looking for people that are very ambitious, that are really hard, have a really good work ethics, even previous to, right, coming into corporate America. So those are some of the attributes that we found that correlate well to high performers that we're looking for when we're sourcing, you know, and building our people organization.
So we're going through a hiring process now for a salesperson at HW. And one thing I've struck by is that, like, there's not necessarily one person who checks every single box that you're looking for. You're more of kind of weighing certain skills versus another set of skills that might not have much overlap or some overlap. How do you weigh different candidates who they might have those qualities, but then stepping into experience set, maybe they know your industry really well, but they've never sold, or they've been a really successful seller, but don't know the industry. Like, how do you kind of weigh the different, like, experience, sales experience, industry, technical expertise? How do you weigh some of those qualities?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really, you know, my experience at Anaplan, where we were growing, you know, the company at sort of 3x every year, which required me, of course, to grow sales capacity at a clip that, you know, is very challenging when you are just trying to source one type of profile. So what we had to do is actually identify and design what we ended up to be three different ideal candidate profiles. And to your point, one profile was folks that came right from the domain. In this case, it was finance. They might have been consultants. They had no sales background. And so we designed these three different profiles, right? One is your typical sales athlete that came from, you know, long, you know, history of selling in the enterprise. The other one was folks that had experience working in finance, right, or doing finance consulting. And so what we did was we designed a sales academy to help those folks, right, that didn't have a sales background, quickly develop those foundational sales skills. And we did that internally with our onboarding and enablement folks, but we'd also look at third parties. There's plenty of sales training firms that you can bring in to help. But that was really critical to our success, is making sure we had that sales academy for folks that didn't have those foundational selling skills. And then I would say on the flip side, for those that don't know the domain, we also had them spend time actually post-sales in the customer journey to learn the customer use cases, how they deployed our software, to, you know, start to learn their lingo, right? Be at the office of the CFO. And I think having customer engagement as part of the onboarding process was really critical for those folks. So bottom line is you can tailor, right, onboarding and enablement based on those different profiles, and you need to really successfully get everyone up to, right, the same level, which is amazing selling skills, right? And also being very credible in speaking the customer's language.
Have you found that there's one skill or quality that you've been able to coach and teach up pretty effectively that maybe on the surface seems more difficult? For example, like, we might have someone who has been a really successful seller, but they haven't sold in real estate before. They're not familiar with the space. We think we could train that person up. And then, you know, vice versa, lots of real estate, no data experience. How do you measure or value the difficulty of different qualities to train?
Well, as you know, vertical SaaS is in vogue, right? And there's plenty of industries that are ripe for disruption for SaaS. And so we're seeing sales folks, right, having to pick up, to your point, right, a new language, right, new industry language, be it real estate, be it construction, be it healthcare. And it is a challenge, right? Because that vertical speak, I think, is something that doesn't necessarily come natural to all of us. And that's back to my point on, you know, having them engage and learn customer stories, having them speak to customers, which is like shadowing, right, customer success calls. You've got to, you know, providing them any type of enablement, research, right, have them go to conferences. It is critical, because what I've seen to be another common attribute of high performers is, especially kind of in the enterprise, this more complex buying process, you have to be, you know, very consultative, really critical to become a trusted advisor. And that means you have to understand their industry. You have to understand their business processes. And so the other way I've done that is working with third-party consultants, which we typically do try and build an ecosystem of third-party consultants that are either advising prospects, right, on kind of a different approach using our software, or helping us, right, implement and sort of scaling out the professional services team with third parties. They typically have that domain expertise. And so having sales reps, right, do, you know, four-legged sales calls where they let the consultant kind of drive the conversation. And hopefully by, you know, osmosis over time, right, they're going to pick up on that language. So there's various ways, I guess, to help sales reps pick up that vertical speak that, as, you know, we've just talked about, I think is really, really critical for them to be credible in the sales process.
What's the four-legged sales call? What's that mean?
Just meaning the sales rep has two legs and the consultant has two legs. So that's cool.
Nice. I like that. You also talked about a sales qualification methodology, Medic, right?
That's right. So I was exposed to Medic, I think probably at IBM, actually. When I was at IBM in the early 2000s, we were very acquisitive. We had bought a lot of software companies. It was a challenging time in the market to grow non-organically. So sure enough, you know, the big companies were highly acquisitive and grew, you know, through acquisition. And so what we did is we bought companies that had an incredible sales methodologies and processes. And one common one that we found was Medic. And that came out of, executives out of PTC that ultimately left and started, you know, and were key executives at a lot of different software companies to this day, still are. And so we found that this was a methodology that once we had a validated opportunity, it was a great framework to train reps on how to do, you know, how to execute in the sales cycle, uncover some gaps, right, that, you know, some blind spots that we had to effectively close the opportunity. And so that was, again, a methodology that we would train, that we would instantiate in our CRM system and then use in key deal reviews, which is another aspect of a high performance culture, is having, you know, some cadence where you bring in anyone involved at the company in sales. And frankly, everyone, I think, should feel like they're in sales, right? So that could be executives, could be, you know, the CMO, could be product executives as well. But we would establish, you know, usually a monthly or quarterly key deal review, and we would have the reps go through the medic qualification of the opportunities, and then coach and inspect and drive to key actions around where we had gaps, whether it was the decision process, whether it was the metrics, whether it was, you know, we didn't have a really strong champion. But again, it's a great methodology and framework to use to help companies improve on opportunity conversion and forecast accuracy.
So you kind of touched on an interesting point there, which is how do you bring other folks from the rest of the team, rest of the company, into sales so they can kind of get a peek into what that process looks like and what prospects are saying and whatnot. What are some effective ways to do that, to involve other folks from, you know, the rest of the organization on somewhat of a regular cadence? Like, what's been working?
There's two ways that I've done that historically. One is through an executive sponsor program. So when we kick off a quarter, we identify the top X amount of deals that are sort of what we call must-win deals. And then based on the profile of the company or of the buying executive, we would map our executives, right, across function. So it could be marketing, could be product, could be finance, whoever. But ideally, you assign a couple key deals to each of our C-suite. And then from there, we would have, as I said, a monthly cadence where we would then do a deal review, and those executives would get exposure to our win plans. And then they would have a role engaging the prospect at certain points of our sales process. And they would feel accountable, just like the sales rep felt accountable. So we drove accountability across the whole C-suite on specific deals. And then the other, of course, benefit is that they get exposure into the market dynamics, right? Whether it be competitive dynamics, whether it be pricing dynamics, whether it be kind of product gap dynamics that we have, that then helps them formulate their key initiatives in their functions, where they need to prioritize to help us obviously win in the marketplace. So it really is a great process that to institute is this executive sponsor program and then key deal review cadence that would be an important outcome from that.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I hadn't heard of a version or a framework like that, but that I like that idea. Where do you see sales teams most often get stuck as they try to grow their headcount?
Finding those profiles that we talked about, whether it be 2, 3, 4, of those ideal candidate profiles, is just trying to figure out where do you source, right? And what I've suggested is the best way to actually source is use those sales reps that you have that fit the profile and have them help you, right? They likely have peers, friends, right? Acquaintances in their network that fit that profile. So one thing that we did when we were in hyperscale mode is we would actually have these sourcing blitz days where we would have the sales reps come in to the room and actually go through their LinkedIn, right? Create that target list and then do some outreach with us to try and generate candidates into our funnel, right? For building the organization. So we looked at people just like opportunities and we had a cadence, right? We had target lists. And that I found was a really great best practice when you're in kind of hyperscale mode of building the organization and leveraging, right, your people, your sales reps to help you build that funnel of candidates.
I like that a lot. What about when, as the company itself grows or attempts to grow and cross certain revenue hurdles, what often gets in the way or what often becomes more challenging?
A couple of things. One is executing a multi-product go-to-market strategy. It's critical. Typically companies, right, they start with one product, they go to market, they get success. And then, where do they go from there? Well, ideally, right, you're building more SKUs or you're acquiring, other companies. But ultimately, right, you want to move towards more of a platform go-to-market strategy where you have multiple SKUs and you're able to get more wallet share with your existing customers. I find that a lot of companies don't have that playbook. Call it the land and expand playbook. And so I've been able to develop that, again, through these great company experiences, through working with a lot of great executives. So I try to help companies with that land and expand strategy. Because again, normally you don't see that companies have that inherent necessarily, right, in their organization in terms of that skill set. The other thing is, marketing source leads, eventually sort of inbound leads. Eventually we see that well runs a bit dry, right, of people in the market actively raising their hand that have real funded projects. And so you have to then develop an outbound playbook for your sales organization. Again, I find that to be a challenge, an obstacle that most of my portfolio companies find. And so I help them, with that exercise as well. It's a heavy lift. Both of those are not easy to do. It does take kind of cross-functional collaboration. And it's really critical though.
Yeah, I remember being on a call with company of the year on the board of, and they had a whole team of BDRs who were, I think, doing like 50 calls a day or something. They clearly had some sort of like a pretty strong outbound process going. What are some of the characteristics of a really high performing prospecting sales function?
Yeah, I think it's multi-medium, right? Is folks, couple of years ago got really caught up in just, batch and blast, right? It was all email-based prospecting. And so now, as you know, we're all inundated with so many outreaches, right, through our email. And so what I've understood is the conversion has really dropped significantly around email prospecting. And so we've now looked at building that back, that old school calling culture, right? as well as using LinkedIn and InMail, using videos. So just trying, right? A-B testing different forms of outreach. And then as folks are constructing their multi-touch cadences and outreaches, right, in the tools, the new tools that we have, is that, you know, it's got to be a combination of calls, InMails, emails, right? It's just one size doesn't fit all is the bottom line. And so just finding what works the best, right? Sharing those best practices across the team, whether it's, you know, in mails or videos, or whether it is, you know, just, you know, on, you know, calling out outbound. Another challenge to that, of course, is that most companies are now, right, remote. So finding their mobile numbers is certainly not easy. And so I think there's now tools that you can, you know, you can acquire that have mobile numbers as well. That's important, right, in terms of that data enrichment. But it's, yeah, it's not easy, but there is some really good playbooks out there, I think, around the outbound, you know, motion that people can rely on and leverage.
Yeah, I've recently been testing Loom videos. And the interesting thing about Loom videos is when you send it, you know when they've watched it, because Loom will tell you, like, hey, you got a view on your video, and you can make it really customized. What are some of the most creative, like, prospecting experiments you've seen folks do?
Yeah, I've seen videos work, as you said just now, mostly with InMail that I've seen. And I think, again, it's just more engaging, right? And so I think we're seeing prospects respond to those. And I think you're trying to, you know, engage them and, you know, in a different way that your competitors are, right? I think also the other thing that I've seen work well is that companies, you know, want to learn from the best companies, right, in their industry. And so doing webinars is another great way to generate demand, where you have, you know, you feature your best customers, and hopefully they have brand names, and they talk about their journey, right, and their successes. And so I think that's been a great way to get prospects also into your funnel, is through these customer webinars that that companies are doing.
Do you see content marketing continue to work kind of like along the lines of webinars or newsletters, company podcasts?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people are hungry to get educated, right? To figure out how they can be best in their craft, right? In their role, and generate value for the company. And also, like I said, learning about, right, what are the key dynamics and what's happening in the industry that helps them be more progressive. And so I've found that commissioning white papers with, like, the McKinseys and the Bains of the world were really helpful, high value pieces of content that I could repurpose, right, through various, you know, marketing campaigns. So I think that's a good best practice that I found prospects really appreciated from a content perspective. And so I think companies are doing ebooks, right, relative to, you know, a variety of topics. Again, mostly focusing on the buyer persona and helping them become more proficient in their role. I think that resonates really well.
You said commission a white paper with a consulting firm like McKinsey. How does that work? What does that end product look like?
Yeah, there's these total economic indexes, or I forget what they call them, but there's, like, different forms of these white papers, right? That, as I said, talk about the business case, right, for doing something different than you are today, what the potential ROI can be. And so those are, like, you know, some of the content in these white papers. And typically it's, you reach out to McKinsey, one of their various, you know, vertical practices, or it could be horizontal practices, depending on, of course, you know, what you're selling. You find one of those consultants, and then usually you pay them a fee, right? They'll figure out how to scope this with you, and then you pay them a fee, and they'll collaborate with you on some sort of engagement, right, to create the content. And the fees range, obviously, but again, it's been tried and true way to create, I think, a very, very high quality piece of content is working with these consultants, these management consultants.
That's interesting. I wrote down that idea because I kind of spurned, you know, the idea of some other...
Total economic impact, that's what it is. It's TEI, is total, yeah. And so you'll see out in the marketplace, if you go to probably various technology company websites, you'll probably see these TEI studies, right, on their website that they make available. And then, of course, they'll use them probably in some email campaigns as well. that's one, you know, variation of this high value white paper that I've talked about.
Yeah, that's brilliant. As a closing thought, what couple pieces of advice do you find yourself commonly or most often giving to CEOs and the heads of sales teams?
People. Most important thing is getting the right people on the bus in the right seats. So you should have some cadence where you're analyzing how you're doing against that, where are your gaps, right? And I think bring people in, especially as you start, you know, an early stage and moving into growth stage, is you definitely need to have key executives that have what I call seen the movie before, right? Hopefully a very successful movie. They can bring in learnings and best practices, as opposed to what I've seen is, you know, a common, I won't say failure, but I think, you know, issue is that companies promote from within to those key executive seats, and they've grown up only at one, you know, one company. They've only seen one movie. It's important to have executives have seen a variety of movies, ideally successful. So having the right people in the, you know, building the right people in the right seats is really the most important thing from what I, from my experience.
I love that. Dennis, thank you for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate it. It's good to chat with you and meet you. And I look forward to chatting again more soon.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Think Like an Owner. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a review and telling a friend to help more folks find Think Like an Owner. I also want to thank our show's sponsors, Hood & Strong, Oberly Risk Strategies, and Ravix Group for supporting the podcast. For full episode transcripts and our weekly newsletter, please visit our website at tlaopodcast.com.